League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Tottenham's story is this. It's time to change the situation if Tottenham wants to change.
I love to win, mate. That's the main thing. Hopefully I can fulfill those dreams and aspirations of every Tottenham supporter.
And still Ricky Villa. What a fantastic run. He scored.
That's going on to have a crack. He is, you know. Oh, I think.
It's a record.
Here's Lucas Moura.
Oh, they've done it.
I'm loving big engines instead. Guess I'm a Spurs fan now then.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Tottenham Way. I'm joined by Tom Allnutt. I'm Tom Barkley, the two Toms from the Sun and the Times, here to reflect a little bit more on that Man City thriller and then on to West Ham later this week. So, Tom, I mean, Man City, what a game. We were wondering how it was going to go with Ange Ball. He promised in his press conference beforehand that he wasn't going to change in his approach despite all the injuries, and he was true to his word, and they came back with a point, a great result given the circumstances and the opposition. And for me personally, I was just blown away by the balls of this guy to approach a game like that in that way. But what were your main takeaways from the game?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, we're sort of squeezing these podcasts in, aren't we? I think next month it's going to be, there's so many fixtures coming every kind of two or three days. We'll just have to kind of squeeze as many pods into the gaps as we can. So, I thought it was obviously an amazing game. You know, it was brilliant to watch. I think everyone sort of expected it to be end-to-end, loads of chances, loads of goals. And that's exactly what it was. And I think from Tottenham's point of view, I thought they played well. You know, I thought, and I agree with you, that the kind of main takeaway was just how refreshing it was to see a team play like this against City, you know, to really try to dominate the ball. And I thought it was interesting. We didn't really get into it in the pre-match press conference, but just in his pre-match interview, Ange kind of just said, he was asked, you know, about his approach, etc. And he kind of said, obviously, it depends on what City allow you to do, you know, and that is true. Like, we were also obsessed with, you know, Spurs playing the Ange way and, you know, no defenders and all this kind of thing. But obviously a match against Manchester City is dictated by Manchester City, you know, and actually that was kind of how it played out. You know, even though Ange probably wanted to have 70% possession and create all the chances, it was actually Manchester City dominating the ball for most of the time. And I guess that is how it is against City. You know, sometimes you just have to take that and you have to survive. It's not a choice. You know, you have to basically defend and go through those spells. And actually, I guess the most kind of distinct Ange fingerprint on this match was how Spurs were basically trying to play out under pressure, how to, you know, playing out from the back. It wasn't so much about dominating the ball and creating loads of chances, you know, playing high up the pitch. It was more about, you know, daring to kind of beat the City press, you know, with Emerson and Ben Davis and Vicario. And obviously, you know, there were some pretty hair-raising moments. I guess that was inevitable. And we have to basically, you know, apply the caveat here that everyone knows that Ange is trying to play Ange ball with players who basically probably aren't really suited to playing Ange ball, Emerson, Davis, etc. And I thought it was really admirable that they stuck to that task. You know, there were some hairy moments, definitely. But to see a team trying to play out like that consistently against City, I thought was thrilling. And you know, actually, ironically, I thought Son's goal was sort of almost Antonio Conte-esque, wasn't it, really? It was counter-attacking. It was, you know, flying forward, quick transition, brilliant from Brian Hill on the edge of the box to kind of spin and keep the counter-attack going, freeing Son, who just did so well to kind of escape the City defender. I can't remember who it was now. Was it Diaz, maybe? And, you know, just a great finish, although Edison probably should have done better. So it was kind of ironic, I thought, that actually that kind of first goal was a pure counter-attacking goal. But, you know, I thought, ultimately, this is a, you know, if we look at the result now, a few days on, it feels like Spurs have released a pressure button, you know, after three consecutive defeats. Yes, this is only 1 point, you know, it's 1 point from four games. But I think the way they played, the fact they got a draw, I thought they could have won it. You know, they actually could have gone on and won the game maybe in the last few minutes. Everyone on telly was sort of expecting City to sort of come back and win, you know, because they had time. But actually, I thought Spurs are the ones who finished the stronger. And you could see at the end, it wasn't just the decision, I don't think, that rattled City. It wasn't just that Haaland, that Grealish decision, which clearly Spurs, you know, were lucky with. I thought City were just rattled generally, you know, that Spurs played so well against them. I thought they gave Guardiola another kind of Spurs challenge, another Spurs test. And I think, let's see, they obviously have to build on this now. And if they go and, you know, lose against West Ham, then it's kind of back to trying to get the season going again. But this is definitely feels like a potential turning point.
Yeah, I was watching back the Sun goal, a terrific counter-attack, as you say, very Conte-esque. And Brian Hill, you know, what a shout-out to him for that bit of skill and composure. Hopefully takes a lot of confidence from that moment. But I also noticed that it was a move that was set off by Vicario. Not quite sure whether it was a sort of flap out from a corner or a intentional palm out, but I'm inclined to think it was probably the latter, having watched him all this season. And once again, I was just so impressed by him. I was looking at the stats before the game, and he hadn't made a single mistake all season long. Stark contrast to obviously the catalogue of errors that Hugo Lloris was producing last season. There was a moment in the second half where he did give the ball away, so I guess that will go down as perhaps one of his first mistakes this season, but he more than made up for it seconds later with that wonderful save to deny Bernardo Silva. And every game, you just can't help but think, wow, what a signing he has been. I mean, James Maddison has been talking this week about Vicario and how before Maddison had actually signed, he was hearing about the players they were looking at, and he had to actually look up Vicario on YouTube because he hadn't heard of him. But it's the same as most fans and even journalists over here. If you don't follow Italian football, why would you have known about him that well? But we know for a fact that Postecoglou definitely did, as did Spurs, and that married up nicely with their recruitment drive in the summer. And he's proved to be an absolutely wonderful signing at a snip of a price. So couldn't help but be really, really impressed with him. Then you look at the tactics that Ange employed. And one of the things I love so much about, or been so impressed by him so far, is how proactive he is with his substitutions, with his change of tactics at times. And even though Hill was probably a bit unlucky to get substitutes just after the just minutes into the second half, he could tell it wasn't working. He obviously had a go at the players at halftime, just like he did in the Shakhtar game in pre-season. Kulusevski revealed that then, and he revealed it again after the game that he was angry at them. And you know, he brought on Højbjerg, who I think we were all thinking is probably not fit for his style long term, but he's obviously got qualities that Postecoglou, you know, respects a lot and thinks he can get a lot out of. And it helped change the game. It gave Spurs a lot more control. And I was really, really impressed with him all round. I mean, what else did you know, individually, which players sort of stuck out to you as any particular sort of talking points off the back of that performance?
Well, just on that, I mean, I thought it was that Højbjerg substitution was really interesting, because I actually thought this game was maybe a slight indication that, you know, Ange does have a pragmatic side. You know, look, I think we've all been talking about him, as we do as journalists, you know, that, you know, in kind of big sweeping broad brushstrokes and narratives. But, you know, I think in a way he gets underestimated as a result, his tactical acumen. You know, we all talk about him as a, you know, flying forward, gung-ho coach. And it almost becomes slightly like a caricature, you know, that he, you know, he doesn't even think about defending. He doesn't even think about the kind of subtleties of the game, when clearly he does. You know, he is a very astute coach, and he, as you say, he's very proactive with his substitutions. And I actually think that this was a game when, you know, bringing on Højbjerg at half time was a move to basically shore up the midfield, to give more control, to give Tottenham a much more solid base, and it completely worked. Like, they were much more stable in the second half with him on the pitch. And yeah, we know that Højbjerg isn't as technically creative or as offensively threatening as Brian Hill, but ultimately it got Spurs back in the match, you know. And even at the end, I saw, you know, Vicario for the first time, I think, you know, going long from a goal kick in I think it was added time, and he basically waved all the defenders up. And I just thought, okay, maybe that was just his own instinctive decision, of course, you know. But there were just some signs, I thought, in this match against City that, you know, Postecoglou is a more rounded coach than perhaps people are giving him credit for. You talk about him as an attacking coach, but he has a slightly more subtle side, if you like, as well. And it worked.
Just on that, I mean, that's what I slightly surprised me with some of the performances of late, because even though he's been branded, like you say, as this attacking coach, gung-ho coach, the Luton game for me, when Bissouma got sent, evidence that he wasn't always like that. I think they did play a lot more pragmatically in the second half. So that's why when they've gone for hell for leather at times, I guess against Chelsea more than anyone, with nine men, that has been a slight surprise, and obviously more ammunition for his critics. And you just mentioned the word gung-ho, as I just said there. It's interesting. Obviously, his approach has been a big talking point. So we both, I presume, have written quite a lot about it this season. Now, with the Times, you can repeat words a bit more. Some we try to use different, you know, second and third and fourth mentions. And I have, this might be a bit journalistic-y, but I've tried my best to avoid the phrase gung-ho, because I don't think it quite is that. But obviously, when you've used attacking approach, you've used, free-flowing, all these different phrases, you're starting to think, should I go down this road and use this particular phrase? But I don't think it's quite accurate, as you've sort of pointed out. I mean, have you found yourself writing that particular phrase this season when trying to describe his approach?
I think so, yeah. But probably just sort of because I can't think of anything else rather than because it's an accurate description. I mean, I agree with you. I think it is slightly, I think it devalues Postecoglou's tactics a little bit. And I also think that in press conferences and his messaging has to be clear. You know, his words have to be emphatic. You know, I don't think at this point, particularly in his tenure, he can give any kind of messaging that seems blurred. You know, he wants to stamp his identity on the club, on the team, on the players. And ultimately he has to show that he's very much on the front foot. So if we ask him, you know, are you going to adapt to this Man City game? He wants the players to have in their mind that the answer to that question is very clearly no. But equally, I think in his tactics and in his decisions during the game, I think he is showing a slightly more subtle approach than perhaps we're giving him credit for. I mean, it is interesting. There was one thing, by the way, on Sky where Jamie Carragher, I think it was, or Gary Neville, and, you know, nothing against them, it's probably unfortunate timing, but they were literally talking about how Spurs should be more, sometimes go longer, sometimes give themselves, I think it was about giving themselves a rest, a deep breath by hitting the ball long sometimes, just being more sensible, you know, and yada, yada, yada. Meanwhile, on the pitch, literally as they were talking, Spurs were putting together this absolutely brilliant move from the back. It went from the goalkeeper through Emerson, through midfield. They turned it, went through the camera. And it was just so, it was a brilliant sort of juxtaposition of the words of the commentators saying, Spurs should, you know, play longer, go more direct, be more sensible. Meanwhile, the players are carving open Manchester City and almost created a fantastic goal. So there is this tension at the moment, I think, between what people think, you know, a winning big side should look like and what Spurs are doing. But I mean, it's interesting. I thought anyway, what you said about Vicario making the mistake to give away a chance, and it is true. And I think we are going to have this thing: what counts as a mistake? Because ultimately, you know, Bissouma, for example, I thought had a really poor game actually, and looked like a player who either is sort of, you know, trying to rediscover his rhythm or perhaps his sharpness. I mean, you know, coming into a game like City when you're not perhaps 100% is obviously a baptism of fire, and Spurs don't have the luxury of warming any players back into action at the moment. But his mistake on the edge of the area for that goal, where he was trying to run out, you know, between two or three City players, does that count as a mistake? Because, you know, Postecoglou wants them to try these things. And ultimately that kind of thing, you know, Brian Hill, for example, not exactly the same, but a very similar situation on the edge of his box, basically tries to spin away from a player, keep the ball alive and keep the counter-attack alive, and Son goes and scores. And that is essentially what Bissouma is trying to do. Instead of just trying to chip the ball down the line, you know, which is what a lot of teams would do, he's trying to keep the attack alive by beating players. And of course, you know, they lose the ball and they lose a goal. But I wonder, and maybe it's something we'll ask him in his press conference before West Ham, you know, did he have a go at Bissouma because of that? Did he see it even as a mistake? Is that an error in Ange ball or is it not? You know, and we have to sort of reevaluate what counts as a mistake, because ultimately these mistakes, you know, maybe 6 or 7 times out of 10 are actually important things that are part of Tottenham's way of playing, and many times will create goals or create openings.
That's a really good point. I wonder if that wouldn't be considered a mistake now, but further down the line, when all the players should be more au fait with his approach, maybe it would be. You know, it's at this point where he's wanting them to play, as was Kulusevski said at half time. That was the word he used. He was getting annoyed at them because they weren't playing enough in the way he wanted them to. So presumably that means taking more risks, just as he was doing that there. But I can't imagine long term he would want his player. Obviously, Bissouma has a incredible knack of like wriggling out of tight situations and being that press resistant player who can start attacks. But when you watch that back, it was probably a little bit too much. And I imagine that's what he would think. But it comes back to what you're saying. And we're having to reevaluate. And I say we, I mean, I'm a journalist, but I'm more the layman. You know, I wasn't a player. I wonder if more to the point, the likes of your Gary Neville and your Jamie Carragher, your pundits who did play the game are having to reevaluate how they look at these performances that Tottenham are putting on, because it does seem to go against the grain of a lot of what we take for as just the way football should be played.
I mean, it's an extension, obviously, of what Guardiola, I wouldn't necessarily say introduced, but certainly, you know, made very fashionable in the Premier League about goalkeepers. You know, when Guardiola first arrived, we had this whole thing with Claudio Bravo, didn't we, and Joe Hart, and basically City were trying to play out from the back, and they kept on. I don't really know if they did keep on, but they made some mistakes, and everyone thought, well, this is crazy, you know. And gradually, other keepers started to do it, and we saw other keepers perhaps who weren't suited to it, trying it and making errors, and everyone's like, well, you know, this is ridiculous. Why are we not, you know, lumping the ball long? And fans, particularly in stadiums, you know, found it quite difficult because, you know, fans want the ball to go forward, and I think everyone had to adjust, you know. And after a while, the messaging kind of seeps through that yes, there will be a mistake, you know, once in every, I don't know, let's say 20 times you try this, there will be a mistake, and that mistake will probably lead to a goal. But 19 times out of 20, you know, you keep the ball, and you don't lose possession, you know, as easily as you would do if you just lump the ball forward. So, and Ange, I guess, is extending that from the goalkeeper through to the defenders, just like Pep has done as well, and Arteta as well. And the difference is that he, at the moment, is playing with players who ultimately are probably not quite well suited enough to play his game. I mean, I actually thought maybe we can move on there to the fringe players, because I thought Ben Davis actually had a pretty good game. I mean, he was culpable for the goal. I can't remember which one it was now, and the one where he dropped too deep and, you know, played him onside, the nice one where Foden scored. But I actually thought overall, you know, he was very committed. He got in front a lot of times. He played really on the front foot. I thought he played pretty well. And okay, this isn't the long-term solution for Ange. You know, if we think, I mean, how many of Emerson, Ben Davis, Højbjerg, and give me another fringe player he's playing at the moment. I don't know. Those three, how many of those three are going to be there next season? I don't know.
Well, maybe. I mean, it's an interesting talking point. I mean, I suppose a lot of it depends on the contractual situation, how long they've got left on their deal. We can all agree that we just can't see Eric Dier being here next season. But someone like Davis, you know, he name-checked, I think, Davis, Emerson, and another player who escapes me right now as being the best trainers in the squad about a month ago or so when none of them were playing. So I don't know whether that was just a bit of, you know, praising the players who are out of the team kind of thing, which you often see with the manager, but seeing how authentic Ange seems to come across, I believe him when he says it. So there's that credit in the bank. You know, you mentioned about getting in front of players. I mean, the Lo Celso goal begins from brave header from Davis, getting in front of, I'm not sure which City player he was marking, but he got in front, header across, and then I think it was Son picked it up, gave it to Lo Celso, who then scores. So, you know, he's making an impact from an offensive side of the game as well. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he was, you know, if he was still there. But yeah, it doesn't seem like the sort of, he's never going to be a regular starter, but it feels like in that back four, and this is what might cause Spurs slight issues in January when trying to sign a new centre-back, is Van de Ven and Romero being fit. I've got those two slots, you know, locked down indefinitely, really, from what we've seen so far. So if you're going to sign a player, a bit like the problem that Spurs have had over the years with a backup to Harry Kane, you know, trying to get a top-class player to come in and be on the bench is very difficult. So if you get someone like Davis, who's got all the attributes of being a great trainer, great pro, you know, classic sort of great lad, all that kind of thing, wealth of experience both internationally at the club, can play in multiple positions. Unless, you know, I know he's playing centre back at the moment, but he's a player who's played, you know, in lots of different positions on the left-hand side in lots of different systems, whether it be Pochettino's more possession-based style or the counter-attacking styles we've seen in the last few years. Like, he has adapted, and he's better technically than people probably give him credit for. So, yeah, I wouldn't see Postecoglou looking to get rid of him, you know, anytime soon, because he's proven that he's an effective backup.
Yeah, I was just watching the game. I wasn't kind of feeling sorry for him. It was more kind of a lot of admiration and respect just for someone who's basically played his whole career playing a different way, you know, and now is. I mean, it'd be like, imagine, you know, if our editor suddenly said to us, okay, guys, we're having a rethink here. You're no longer writing your articles. You have to go on YouTube and, you know, sing them, you know, every week. And, you know, me and you would probably be like, no, we're not doing that. I'm going to go and join, you know, a different newspaper, join the BBC or something. Like, and that's basically what probably Eric Dier is thinking right now. He's like, no, I'm not into this. Like, I'm going to go and play for Sporting or something, because that's what I can do. I know what I'm like. But fair play to Ben Davis and Emerson Royale. It might not be the best thing ever. They might not be the best singers on YouTube, but they're giving it a go. You know what I mean? They're trying and they're doing their best. And I know that sounds a bit sort of trite, but I just watched the match and thought, look, you're playing a way that is clearly uncomfortable to your skill set. You're playing against Haaland and Manchester City in the toughest game in the world right now. And actually, they did a fairly decent job. You know, I'm not saying they were fantastic or this is the long-term solution, but they're stepping up in a really difficult situation. So
I think that's what's often over, you know, it's easy to dismiss all the injuries they've got. And you're right, Emerson is playing out of position. I mean, Davis has played centre-back before, not so much in a back four, more in the left side of a three. But yeah, there are times when Emerson does look quite uncomfortable, but it's, you know, to be expected. So it's just not his position. He, for me, doesn't seem like someone who is here for the long term under Postecoglou. Unless he's happy to be a sort of backup player who's, as I said, dependable, good trainer, will give it his all. But yeah, it's hard to see that one in that way.
I mean, it's worth saying, moving on to West Ham, if you think about the defence now, you know, with Romero back, it feels suddenly like there's a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. You know, for a while it's just been so bare bones, but actually they'll have a back four, what we presume will be back five, Vicario, Porro, Romero, okay, Davis still in for Van de Ven and Udogie, you know, and okay, suddenly it looks like a back five that is resembling what it was before, and it's not Van de Ven, it's not perfect, but you think with Romero back, it just suddenly gives them a much more stable base.
Yeah, certainly. I wonder, it'd be interesting to know if Ange had a word with Romero at all during this period, because he's such a loss when he's not there, and he was doing so well from a discipline point of view. Not just obviously lack of red cards, but he had hardly been booked this season. And then, you know, he had a nightmare against Chelsea, and it's cost them big time, him not being there. So I won, you know, and just played it down the whole time. I remember asking him after the game after the Chelsea game about it. And ever since, he's just said, you know, he's the kind of player who plays on the edge effectively. And it's what happened. But he's got to rein it in a little bit, surely, because he's so crucial.
Deployed, disappointed dad approach, 100%. Like, I don't think he would have been, you know, having a massive go at Romero, because I think he knows that this is kind of part of the package. But equally, you know, we heard him so much talk about Romero in those weeks before the Chelsea game, about how much of a leader he'd been, how important he was to that kind of back five, because he was basically playing with four players who had essentially just joined. And he was really bigging him up as kind of this linchpin almost, you know, the kind of one of the fulcrums of his new team. So I think he'll feel like he'll be wanting to say to Romero, you know, you let me down, basically, you know, and you owe the team. And he said that with Bissouma, didn't he, when he got sent off against Luton? He said, you know, I think Bissouma will feel like he owes the team when he comes back. And I think that's what he'll be hoping to see from Romero.
Although Bissouma's kind of case in point, really, of it's not so easy just to pick up your form straight away after a bit of a break. I mean, he hasn't quite hit the same heights since he's come back. I mean, he was arguably the best player in the Premier League on form in those first few games. So let's hope Romero doesn't have a similar drop-off, and let's hope Bissouma can pick it up soon. I mean, back to your sort of bigger point about the options, it's not just in defence. Suddenly, in midfield, despite an absolute sort of spate of injuries to key players like Maddison, Bentancur, et cetera, et cetera. If, for example, Pap Sarr comes back, he obviously missed out with a hamstring problem, which he picked up on international duty with Senegal. So he's missed the last two games, but we're not sure. We'll find out whether he's back. But if he is, you know, with the emergence of Lo Celso or re-emergence of Lo Celso, he definitely deserves a mention. Bissouma will be back in. Højbjerg now offering a headache more than, you know, if anything, to Postecoglou. And Kulusevski thriving, to be honest, at times in that more central position. I guess the question is, when we looked at the squad at the start of the season, I think everyone thought, quite like this first 11, but it looks very thin, this squad. Now, even with all these injuries, obviously at centre-back, there's issues. But is this squad a lot deeper than people gave it credit for?
Maybe, but I mean, you know, they have just lost three on the bounce and drawn one, you know. So, I mean, we can't suddenly claim that this is the fringe players have, you know, kept Spurs going from where they were before, because they haven't. The results haven't been great. Yes, against City, you know, I thought they put in a decent performance and they're definitely now on a different kind of note going into this West Ham game. But I think there's still such a big drop off from that kind of first seven or eight players, particularly the kind of key seven or eight, from then the backup sort of 7 or 8 to 15. I think there's a massive drop off, and that's what they have to start. You know, they did start addressing it last summer. They need to continue that in January with another two or three additions, I think. And then again next summer, and we might then next season just start to see the kind of actual squad rather than team that Ange wants. I mean, I think the Kulusevski's one is really interesting because I think he's played really well in that number eight kind of position. And I wonder if Ange will, because, you know, they have more options in midfield, in that midfield three. So they could push Kulusevski back into the front three, I guess play Son, Kulusevski and Johnson, assuming they don't think Richarlison is quite ready for a start. Or they keep Kulusevski in midfield and put Richarlison into front three and drop Brian Hill and play Richarlison, Son and Johnson up front with a kind of midfield of what, Kulusevski, Bissouma and Lo Celso, I guess, which actually is a front six. Doesn't sound too bad at all. So, I mean, I would be inclined, not that anyone cares what I think, but I think, you know, in a way, Kulusevski has been playing well. Why move him? You know, if you've got people playing well at this point when Spurs haven't got a wealth of options, you know, then I think you keep him there. But maybe he'll want to bring the balance back into midfield.
Yeah, I'd be inclined to agree with you, really. I think Kulusevski maybe should stay in that number 10 or central position, because without Maddison and his ability to pick a pass, they don't really have that in the team as much, unless, you know, Lo Celso, who seemed the most obvious replacement for Maddison with that skill set, grows in confidence from a couple of goals and starts to, you know, really put his stamp on games and starts playing like that. But I think the way Kulusevski's approaching these games and having such an impact, I would be inclined to keep him more in the middle and maybe look to bring in Richarlison over Hill, as well as Hill did for that opening goal. I think that a bit of extra physicality for Richarlison if he's in a fit state after surgery, which really wasn't very long ago. I quite liked him off the left. You know, I'm still not 100% convinced he is a player for Ange long term, but he does have skills. It's just the fact that he cost so much money and had such a difficult season last year that he's not been written off completely by fans. But I guess the expectation level on him has dropped a little bit. But I think him against Koufal could be quite an interesting matchup if he's ready for the game. But looking at West Ham, Tom, against City, there was obviously a lot of noise about Ange's approach and whether he would adapt it and whether he should do. Obviously, he said he wasn't going to. And ultimately, they got a great result out of it. How important do you think it was that they actually got that draw as opposed to a defeat? Because we know that he probably wouldn't have changed even if they had lost, because he's trying to instill a way of playing and he's, you know, headstrong enough to keep down that line of thinking despite all the, you know, externally people criticizing him or putting pressure on him to change. But four defeats in a row, you know, that decibel level of people criticizing his approach would have only gone up more. Do you think the fact that they didn't lose alleviates the pressure a little bit going into what is historically quite a tricky game, West Ham home for Spurs?
I think the performance was the main thing. I think if they'd lost 3-2, you know, playing the way they did, I actually don't think everyone would have been doom and gloom about it. I think it was all about the performance. I think the one scenario where I think there might have been, you know, a kind of crescendo of noise, as you put it, is if they'd got thumped, you know, if they'd lost 4 or 5 nil and they'd been playing, you know, all out attack and City had taken them apart, then I think that might have been a slightly different scenario. Then there might have been some more questions about everything. But I think, as it was, the point was obviously a very welcome bonus, and it gave Spurs a real feeling of vindication, yes, but also just that they deserved it. You know, they got something they really deserved for their kind of, you know, their braveness and their daring in that game. But I actually think if they had lost narrowly, playing the way they did, bigger picture here, you know, I think that would have been okay. And I think the most important thing now is that they build on it, you know, because they've now got actually a run of fixtures, which doesn't look too bad. You know, they've had a really sticky run, you know, with a really bare bones team. And now actually, if you look at December, West Ham, okay, Newcastle's a tough game, but both of those games at home, Forest, Everton, Brighton, who have been a bit up and down this season, Bournemouth, Burnley, you know, and then United in January, who, you know, who knows what's going to be happening with them by then. But that's a run of 6 or 7 games there, where Spurs can go into virtually every one of those games looking to win. You know, and I'm not saying that's going to happen, but they could put together a nice little run here where they could actually build some momentum again going into the new year. And I think that's what they've got to do. I think we said, you know, before last week that this patch now, before they get Maddison back and Van de Ven in January, which isn't that far away, it's now next month, you know, it's 5 or 6 weeks, perhaps a bit longer for Van de Ven maybe. They need to just hang in there, you know, they need to stay tight with Newcastle and Liverpool and not let those gaps get too big. And I think there is an opportunity there. And listen, West Ham, I've seen them a few times this season. They're a decent team, but they're not the same West Ham, I don't think, as last year yet. Jarrod Bowen is obviously the main threat, plays down the middle at the moment, very good in the air, big threat in the air. And that could cause Spurs some problems with their kind of lack of height at the moment. But I think if they can get a positive result here, you know, it doesn't have to be a brilliant Ange 4-0 win, although, you know, he'd love that. But if they could get a result, 1-0, 2-0 or something like that, then I think everyone would feel like a corner has been turned. And it is important, because I think if they come out of that City game with all the positivity, you know, and 2 or 3 days later go and, you know, draw with West Ham or even lose, then I think they'll be right back to where they were before. So it's important that all that good work at City is now built on against West Ham.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I would add that Kudus looks like he's playing really, really well. Seems to have found his feet for West Ham now. So he's definitely a danger man, kind of player that you would have thought Spurs might have had a look at in the summer too. So I'm sure he'll, if he's playing down the right, that could be quite an interesting battle between him and Udogie. But yeah, I mean, it's just credit to Ange overall with all these injuries that they are in a position now where, they, you know, things could look quite positive, but it does feel like this game hinges quite a lot on it, really. If they can get a victory, the narrative could change quite quickly. But we'll be there to review it afterwards, and we'll find out how they got on at home to West Ham. But for now, Tom, thanks for listening.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.